The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Katie Neuhauser for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Religion News Service. And before I start my first article, I would like to wish everyone out there a happy Mother's Day. Okay, Article 1 is entitled, for today, Marco Rubio may lean on a complicated Catholicism when he meets with the Pope. And the little byline here that kind of tells us what this article is going to be about says, although he has said that as a Catholic, he supports 100% the teaching authority of the Church, Rubio has also said the Pope only has authority on some topics. Here we go. Shortly after Pope Leo XIV was elected last May, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, himself a Catholic, was asked about his thoughts on the newly minted pontiff's comments signaling deep concern for immigrants. After defending President Donald Trump's mass deportation efforts, which Pope Leo would end up publicly criticizing, Rubio, the son of immigrants, downplayed the Pope's political relevance. I don't view the papacy as a political office, Rubio said. I view it as a spiritual one. But when asked by White House reporters on Tuesday, May 5th, about his meeting with the Pope, slated for later this week, the secretary suggested Leo may have significant political cachet after all. The Pope is obviously the vicar of Christ as a Roman Catholic, but he's also the head of a nation state, Rubio said, outlining his hopes for partnering with the Holy See on various topics, such as religious liberty. It's an organization that has a presence in over 100-something countries around the world, and we engage with the Vatican quite a bit because they're present in many different places. The shift hints at the unusual and unusually contentious relationship the Trump administration has forged with the Vatican under Pope Leo, a dynamic that Rubio, arguably the second most prominent Catholic in the president's cabinet after Vice President J.D. Vance, will be forced to navigate even after his meeting with Leo. It is perhaps an especially tricky task for Rubio, who has insisted the Church played a major role in the U.S. founding, and who has invoked Catholicism while defending U.S. policies criticized by multiple popes. Navigating tensions between the White House and the Vatican is certain to color Rubio's conversation with Leo, which U.S. officials have said they expect to be frank. Last fall, Leo, the first U.S.-born pope, referred to the treatment of immigrants in the U.S. under Trump as inhumane and called for the U.S. government to allow faith leaders greater access to immigrant detainees. Leo has also criticized the war with Iran in recent weeks, calling on Americans, as well as citizens in other countries involved, to contact their government leaders and say, "We don't want war, we want peace." The Pope's comments have, in turn, sparked backlash from Trump, who decried the pontiff as weak on crime in a lengthy social media post. Trump has also suggested Leo's views on foreign policy are endangering a lot of Catholics and a lot of people, and that the pontiff wants Iran to have a nuclear weapon. The public back and forth continues to rage as of Wednesday when Leo was asked about Trump's latest comments by reporters outside the papal residence. The mission of the Church is to proclaim the gospel, to preach peace, Leo said. If someone wants to criticize me for proclaiming the gospel, let them do so truthfully. For years, the Church has spoken out against all nuclear weapons, so there is no doubt on that point. It would be a delicate situation for any Secretary of State, but perhaps especially for Rubio, who has spoken about his faith publicly on numerous occasions. Although he has said that, as a Catholic, he supports 100% the teaching authority of the Church, when Pope Francis issued encyclicals and apostolic exhortations that called for actions on climate change and criticized trickle-down economics ahead of the 2016 election, then Republican presidential candidate Rubio insisted the Pope only has authority on some topics. On moral issues, he speaks with incredible authority, Rubio told Fox News in 2015. He's done so consistently on the value of life, on the sanctity of life, on the importance of marriage, and on the family. On economic issues, the Pope is a person. It is unclear how Rubio's same argument would play with Leo on issues such as immigration and war. The Pope recently decried Trump's threat to eradicate Iran's entire civilization as truly unacceptable and railed against the politicization of religion last month during a visit to Cameroon. Woe to those who manipulate religion in the very name of God for their own military, economic, and political gain, dragging that which is sacred into darkness and filth, Leo said. Even so, Rubio may hope to avoid controversy as much as possible. He suggested during his discussion with White House reporters that he is interested in potential partnerships with the Vatican that involve protecting persecuted Christians abroad and distributing humanitarian aid to Cuba through the Catholic Church. We're willing to give a more humanitarian aid to Cuba, distributed through the church, but the Cuban regime has to allow us to do it, Rubio said. They won't allow us to give their own people more humanitarian aid, and we're willing to do it through the church. Bolstering Vatican ties may push Rubio to draw on his Catholic faith during his meeting with Leo, which the secretary has said was planned before the heated exchanges between Trump and the pontiff made international headlines. And the meeting comes at a time when Rubio appears to be leaning into his Catholic roots. On Monday, Republican National Committee spokesperson Kirsten Pelz said in a tweet that she has seen Rubio at Catholic services regularly. Reached by Religion News Service on Wednesday, Pelz declined to name publicly which church Rubio attends, citing security concerns. But she said she has spotted the secretary at a Washington, D.C. church for months during midday and evening masses, describing him as quiet and humble during services. The secretary's re-embrace of Catholicism is the latest chapter in his complicated religious journey. Although he was baptized Catholic and wrote in his 2012 memoir about being once a Catholic, always a Catholic, in his youth, Rubio was briefly a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. He later recanted his ties to the LDS Church, but is known to have attended services at a Southern Baptist church in Florida as recently as 2015 when he was running for president. His affiliation with both traditions eventually spurred some, such as the New York Times religion columnist Mark Oppenheimer, to ask, Marco Rubio, Catholic or Protestant? Rubio has said he read the entire Catechism of the Catholic Church between 2004 and 2005 while reacquainting himself with the tradition and has since made his faith a bigger part of his public persona. When he delivered a speech in 2019 at the Catholic University of America's Bush School of Business, he framed his remarks around an encyclical by Pope Leo XIII, the same pope from whom the current Pope Leo draws inspiration. And Rubio also appealed to his faith last month during a pre-taped speech shown during a conference organized by the Center for the Constitution and the Catholic Intellectual Tradition. While discussing the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, Rubio acknowledged that only one of the signers was Catholic, but argued that Catholicism was interwoven with U.S. history. Standing in front of a State Department logo, Rubio pointed to the influence of Catholics in establishing colonist projects in what eventually became the U.S., such as Christopher Columbus, and Spanish settlers who established cities, such as St. Augustine, in what is now Florida. Rubio then argued that the U.S. founding wasn't merely a brainchild of the Enlightenment or a radical rupture with the past, but an outgrowth of broader efforts ushered in by Catholicism. The American political system, he said, belongs to the same civilizational tradition that produced the towering cathedrals of Rome and the philosophy of Augustine and Aquinas. America was a gift where the church and the civilization it made was reborn, discovering itself anew in the wilderness. He added, "To look upon the history of this golden land is to see the face of God. It's an open question whether Pope Leo, who has been stridently critical of nationalism, would agree. But Rubio, who appears to be eyeing a healthier or at least less contentious relationship with the Vatican, may be hoping the Pope at least sees the U.S. Secretary of State as a potential partner." And that is the end of our first article for the day. Next up, we have an article entitled, "After She Complained of Gender Bias, a PCA Church Fired Her. A Judge Ruled It Retaliation." And the byline, the description of what's to come, says, "A judge for the Illinois Human Rights Commission ruled that Naperville Presbyterian Church fired a longtime staffer after she complained of being treated differently from male leaders. The church is led by author and pastor Dane Ortlund." Okay, here we go. A Chicago area church led by best-selling author and pastor Dane Ortlund must pay $93,000 in back wages and damages to a former staffer after a judge ruled the church retaliated against her. Administrative Judge Azima Akram of the Illinois Human Rights Commission ruled last week that Naperville Presbyterian Church's firing of Emily Highland in 2021 after she claimed she had been mistreated because of her gender, it qualified as retaliation and it violated Illinois law. Complainant successfully proved retaliation by a preponderance of the evidence, as she was able to show that she engaged in a protected activity when she complained about sex-based discrimination, that respondent knew about it, and that there was a causal nexus between her complaints and her subsequent termination, Akram wrote in her decision. Akram also ruled that Highland failed to prove the church had discriminated against her. Church officials argued that Highland was fired for poor job performance and denied any retaliation. The ruling came just over 5 years after Highland was terminated from her role at Naperville Presbyterian, a Presbyterian church in an American congregation, where she had worked for 7 years as a director of operations. She had also been a member of the congregation for about 15 years at the time of her firing. "I feel vindicated that what I believed to be true years ago was supported by testimony and evidence," Highland told Religious News Service. The ruling describes a fraught working relationship between Highland and Ortlund, who became pastor of Naperville Presbyterian in 2020. Tensions between the two began a few months after Ortlund started as pastor, according to the ruling, mostly over a lack of communication. Ortlund did not immediately respond to a texted request for comment. Highland claimed that Ortlund rarely spoke to her at the office, but often sent emails after she had left for the day, making it hard for her to do her job. She also worried that Ortlund would meet with male staff members, but not her, according to court records. Conversely, Pastor Ortlund, who was apparently an avid email user, was frustrated that complainant was not responding regularly or at all to his emails, which he often sent out outside of regular work hours, Akram wrote. A few months in, Ortlund had begun a paper trail of complaints against Highland. Tensions got worse after Highland sent a survey to the congregation with a question that pastors objected to, leading one of the pastors to complain that Highland would not follow directions. That led to a January 2021 meeting where Highland met with two pastors to discuss her performance. Things went poorly at the meeting. For the next 45 minutes, Pastor Ortlund apparently lectured complainant about the three areas in which he had identified performance issue: poor communication, insubordination, and interpersonal relations and or dynamics. And then he gave examples of each. The ruling reads, "The three planned to meet again that March to discuss whether things had improved, but the working relationship continued to deteriorate, leading Highland to worry she was being treated differently from her male colleagues," according to the ruling. In early March, Highland complained to church elders, alleging she was being bullied and mistreated. Just over a week later, she was fired. The haste and haphazardness with which respondent fired complainant suggests it was occasioned by her quote-unquote insubordination, which in this instance consisted not of poor performance, but of complainant's action of complaining to the elders about Pastor Ortlund's differential treatment of women, Akram wrote. Church leaders argued they were not aware Hyland had complained about discrimination, a claim that Akram did not find credible. Simply put, respondents' witnesses were less credible than complainant, as their testimony at trial seemed to discount even the possibility that gender discrimination could exist at the church, Akram wrote. The judge awarded Hyland $39,246.60 in back wages, $50,000 in damages for emotional distress, and $4,511 for out-of-pocket medical expenses. The church was also ordered to pay Hyland's legal fees. While courts rarely get involved in the inner workings of churches and other houses of worship, because of First Amendment protections for religious freedom, Akram wrote that she had jurisdiction because the case did not involve matters of doctrine or beliefs. Hyland said that while she is relieved at the ruling, her departure from the church still hurts because she lost not just her job but her faith community, as she was no longer welcome at the church after her firing. Nobody should ever lose their job and church community in the same afternoon, she said. She said Naperville Presbyterian had policies that would protect employees against retaliation, but the church did not follow them. Hyland said she once believed the church would look out for her best interests. Now her trust in church leaders is gone. It's all an illusion, she said. Hyland, who recently converted to Catholicism, said she'd found a new church and moved on. She said churches need to listen to their employees rather than just trusting that the pastor is always right. People should feel safe in their organization to report concerns that they have about how they are being treated. And this ends article number 2 for today. Our third article is entitled, Worship Attendance at Churches Up for the First Time in Decades, According to New Report. And the byline description says, researchers from the Hartford Institute for Religion Research said the median congregation grew from 65 in 2020 to about 70 today. That is not enough to erase earlier declines, but it is noteworthy. Okay, and the article begins. The past 25 years have been rough for American churches and other houses of worship. The median worship attendance dropped by more than half. Church closures and the rise of the nuns, those who claim no religion, have grabbed all the headlines. And faith in institutions like organized religion has plummeted. Yet, a new report from the Hartford Institute for Religion Research shows signs of a shift. For the first time in two decades, attendance is up. More people are volunteering, and there also seems to be a renewed sense of optimism among pastors and other clergy. The headline finding is cautious optimism, Allison Norton, co-director of the Hartford Institute for Religion Research, told reporters at the annual conference of the Religion News Association meeting in Atlanta. She added that the data showed a story of resilience and recalibration. Across a range of indicators, there are signs of recovery and, in some cases, renewal, the study's authors wrote in a report released Friday, April 24th, which surveyed a representative sample of leaders at 7,453 congregations between September and December of 2025. Median in-person attendance, which dropped from 137 in 2000 to 45 during COVID-19, is now at 70 adults, which is higher than the 2020 Faith Communities Today survey from the Hartford Center for Religious Research. That report found that the median attendance was 65. Researchers said the attendance growth, which is self-reported by the surveyed congregations, is not enough to reverse years of decline. Still, said Scott Thuma, director of the Hartford Institute for Religion Research, it has been a long time since there has been any uptick. Thuma said researchers had expected to see continued decline and withdrawal. We were pretty surprised when we saw the 2025 data, he He added that for many congregations, this might be the first sign that the trajectory of decline might be shifted. As the report noted, this is the first positive gain in median attendance in 25 years. Catholic and Orthodox congregations had the highest reported median attendance, 200, in part because those traditions have fewer parishes than Protestants. The median evangelical congregation reported 75 worshipers, while the median mainline church reported 50. Just under half of the congregations, which is 43%, said they grew by at least 5%, while a similar number, 46%, reported declining by at least 5%. The rest said they were stable. For the first time in decades, more congregations are stabilizing or growing rather than shrinking, the authors wrote. Thuma said that larger congregations are more likely to grow, while smaller congregations are more likely to decline. After years of constraint, even modest gains can feel like recovery for these congregations, Thuma said at the Religion News Association conference. The report is part of a long-term study of congregations during the COVID-19 era and beyond. The survey asked about attendance, giving, volunteers, and demographics, as well as how church members and leaders felt about the future of their congregations. About half of the congregations were in the South, with the rest split between the Midwest, the Western U.S., and the Northeast. Earlier studies by Hartford showed that at first congregations responded to the pandemic by adapting quickly to streaming and finding ways to minister when they could not gather in person. Then there was a lull as the pandemic stretched on and churches went into survival mode. Now that period seems to be over, said Clarissa Mikoski, an assistant professor at Hartford Institute for Religion Research, who also worked on the study. And the churches that are growing, said Mikoski, are implementing the lessons of resilience they learned during the pandemic. This is not just recovery, it's adaptation and experimentation, said Mikoski. When the data showed attendance was up, researchers were skeptical. We did go back and check very thoroughly, Mikoski said. Other groups like the Pew Research Center have shown that the decline of religion in the U.S. has stabilized, at least for now, she said. The study also found that fewer clergy are thinking about leaving the ministry. It's not too surprising if the congregations are feeling better and more volunteers are showing up. The clergy are going to start to feel better, said Thuma. Thuma suspects the pandemic acted a little bit like a wake-up call for churches. They could no longer pretend that everything was okay, and they had to start making changes for the future. One other positive coming out of the pandemic, giving is up in large part because of a growth in online giving, said Thuma. People no longer need to be physically present or even remember to give in the moment, said Thuma. Median income grew from $120,000 in 2020 to $205,000 in 2025. The number of churches offering online giving rose from 58% in 2020 to 76% in 2025. And as of 2025, about 40% of revenue came from online giving. Even evangelical and non-Christian congregations were most likely to report a surplus. Mainline churches were more likely to report deficits. Thuma also noted that church expenses, especially for insurance and other building expenses, have grown. Thuma said that it will take some time to know if this growth will continue. The center is planning for a major survey of congregations in 2030 that may shed more light. The authors of the report were quick to say there's no major revival in Christianity. The longer trajectory of decline remains in place, they noted, but congregations do seem to be moving past survival mode and planning for the future. What it is not, is a story of revival or return to a previous era of sort of congregational glory in the United States, said Norton. Congregations have been through an extraordinary period of disruption, and though it has taken a while, many have come out of it with greater clarity about who they are and what they're called to do. That's showing up in the data in ways that are genuinely encouraging. And that's the conclusion of that article. So I'm watching my time here. I think I have time to read a little bit of one more article. And this one is short, but I may not get through it. It is entitled, Counterterror Police Probe Arson Attack. They probe arson attack at the former London synagogue amid anti-Semitic attacks. Byline reads, the number of anti-Semitic incidents reported across the UK has soared since the attack by Hamas-led militants on southern Israel on October 7, 2023, and the subsequent war in Gaza, according to the Community Security Trust Charity. Counter-terror police in Britain were investigating an arson attack at a former London synagogue Tuesday as Prime Minister Keir Starmer hosted a meeting to respond to a wave of anti-Semitic attacks that have caused outrage and fear in the Jewish community. Gates and a lock on the front of the former temple in the Whitechapel area of East London had minor damage, but no one was injured, Metropolitan Police reported. The incident is the latest since four ambulances owned by a Jewish charity were torched in March. Since then, a synagogue was firebombed, and other Jewish sites have been targeted in attempted arson. Last week, two Jewish men were stabbed in what police have called an act of terror. It is part of a pattern of rising anti-Semitism that has left our Jewish communities feeling frightened, angry, and asking whether this country, their home, is safe for them. Starmer told community leaders, these disgusting attacks are being made against British Jews. But make no mistake, this crisis, it is a crisis for all of us. The number of anti-Semitic incidents reported across the UK has soared since the attack by Hamas-led militants on southern Israel on October 7, 2023, and the subsequent war in Gaza, according to the Community Security Trust Charity. The group recorded 3,700 incidents in 2025, up from 1,662 in 2022. Hate crime prosecutions will be fast-tracked to deal with the spike in anti-Semitic incidents, Director of Public Prosecutions Stephen Parkinson said. The attacks have occurred since the February 28th start of the Iran war, and police are looking into whether they are the work of Iranian proxies. Starmer promised to take action to tackle anti-Semitism, including requiring universities to publish the scale of the problem and take steps to stop it. Arts funding will be withdrawn from anyone promoting anti-Semitism. Well, we almost made it to the end of that article, but we have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Katie Neuhauser, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That, again, is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.